any other devices that might disrupt the lecture. Thank you very much. I suspect that many of you, like me, have been reading Michael Derda's columns in the Washington Post for quite some time. So it's really a pleasure for us to welcome him here tonight. We like to say that we're a real reader's library. You know, all of you know that our book stacks are crammed with long-forgotten gems. You know, those authors that were once popular, like E. Phillips Oppenheim and Stanley Wyman and Edgar Wallace.
I just bought a book by E. Phillips Oppenheim this afternoon.
There you go. We probably have 75 of his books on the shelf. That's not even his whole oeuvre. You know, the Reading Browsing is Michael Derda's latest collection of essays that he wrote for the American Scholar. I get the feeling that you wish that these books were and authors were no longer quite so forgotten as well. And in fact, I read at one point in the essays, I read with interest his desire to have a forum, a regular forum, for extolling the virtues of some of these out-of-print favorites. Well, I'm here to help, because I would love for you to have a regular or occasional post on our blog, introducing people to some of these classics. I'm sure that you guys would love that. Would you not?
Yes.
So, it would be fantastic. We have, we do try very hard to try to get people into the stacks and pull some of these things out because, it is harder to find them now, and we've been collecting them for a long time. And it's always really fun to kind of find these forgotten authors and get them back out into the world. The subtitle of Browsings is If You're Reading, Collecting, and Living with Books, and it's a wonderfully enjoyable, engaging collection of essays for book lovers, written by the person who is regularly called the best read man in America. I don't know if you get tired of hearing that. I have to agree with the Library Journal reviewer who wrote, although Derda recommends reading only two or three of his pieces at a time, his exuberance is infectious, and the book is hard to put down. Michael Derda is a Pulitzer Prize-winning critic, a longtime book columnist for the Washington Post. He also writes regularly for the Times Literary Supplement, the New York Review of Books, and others, and is the author of four collections of essays, a memoir, and on Conan Doyle, for which he won an Edgar Award. So please welcome Michael Derda.
And thank you for that kind introduction. Before we go any further, let's get the microphone set so it's not either too soft or too loud. Is this good or not? Do you have any hearing aids? No echo area, that sort of thing? Okay. If I drift away too much from the mic, let me know, signal wildly. I'm really an extremely casual speaker. I'm not a formal lecturer at all. I enjoy talking about books with people, so I encourage you to have questions. We're trying to leave time for questions about this book, about book reviewing, or publishing, or Washington Post, or journalism, or any of those things where I have some connection. I was told that most of these sorts of events, people don't really like to have essays or poems or stories read to them. And so I'm not going to do much of that. I might read a little snatch or two of a couple of pieces. Instead, I thought I would just talk a little bit about how I came to write these pieces, and a little bit about my life and how I got involved in literary journalism, as they call it these days. It didn't start out that way. I grew up in a small working-class steel town. My parents had quit school as teenagers. Nobody in my family read books. But my mother taught me to read when I was a little boy. And that really made all the difference in my life. I just discovered that stories were adventures. They were a lot of fun. It amazes me to think, as I was just this past week, that one of the people who taught me to read her 100th birthday on April 12th. It's just telling earlier this evening about, I once wrote an essay about Henry Huggins, her first book, which was for a book called something like Everything I Ever Learned About Life I Learned From Children's Books, because it was it introduced me to moral complexity. Up till then, I thought, you know, books had happy endings in adventures, Mrs. Got Home, fairy tales ended happily. But at the end of Henry Huggins, you may recall, you all read this book, if not, you can get a copy upstairs. A boy has found a stray dog, taken care of it, come to love it, named it Lindsay. But he thought it was abused, but in fact, he had run away from a very kind master, who at the end of the book appears. He's lost his dog, discovered where it was, and naturally wants it back. And he calls the dog something like Aloysius or whatever, some very fancy name. What to do? So they decide to put the dog in the middle of the sidewalk, and they each go to one end of the driveway or whatever, and call to the dog, either Rizzi or the other name, whatever it was. The dog waffles back and forth, and everyone's, there's a lot of tension, but finally the dog goes to Henry Huggins, and all the kids are happy, Henry gets to keep his dog. And I said, yeah, but what about the other guy? What about this young man who loves this dog? He supposedly has visitation rights or something, come to see the dog. But it really made me understand that books were not simple stories, that they could raise complicated questions and dilemmas. And I've always thought that that was the book that made, started me on a path to becoming a more serious reader than someone who just did strictly for pleasure. Although I'm a great believer in reading for pleasure. All my books tend to have pleasure in the title. One of them is called Bound to Please, which I was happy to get by my publisher since there are innuendos there. Anyway, I grew up in this working class steel town, Lorain, Ohio. Anyone who recognize the name Lorain, Ohio? Why do you know the name Lorain, Ohio?
My daughter went to Oberlin.
Oh, okay. The daughter went to Oberlin, I went to Oberlin. Oberlin is 13 miles from Lorain. Lorain's also the hometown of Toni Morrison. And we once had a conversation about growing up in Lorain, the National Book Festival. It's a classic blue-collar steel town. And it was a great place to grow up. I had no necessary intention of going to college. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college. My parents didn't know that I would. I was an extremely uneven student in high school. By the way, I write about all these in a book called An Open Book, a memoir. And I got to be a senior, and I decided that I wanted to go to college, but I didn't know much about colleges or universities, because Admiralty High School had about 600 in my graduating class, maybe 20 kids went to school. Most kids got married. But I had a teacher once who said, you should go to a small liberal arts college. So I looked around and I realized Oberlin was 13 miles away. So I made my parents promise never to come visit me. And I wrote them a letter. I said, if you look at my grades, you'll see they're very uneven. This is the fall of my senior year where I've just gotten a D in English on the report. But they gave me a scholarship along and a job. I would work really hard, and they would be proud of me one day. Well, I did have the knack for scoring phenomenally well on standardized tests, even though I was such a bad student. Anyways. So Oberlin bought this, basically. They asked me to write some essays. I wrote some essays, and they said, okay, we'll let you in. They got all their money back when my little son went there, and I had to pay every penny. It was a great place for me. It transformed my life. Got there, and I'd grown up in thinking that Lawrence Welk was classical music. As most of you know, Oberlin has a conservatory. I'd never been to Oberlin, even though it's 13 miles away. My parents never went anywhere. Actually, I'd gone there once on my bicycle. I was writing a term paper on New Sub, and I couldn't find any books in the library. I didn't know anything about the place. But I got there during freshman orientation, and George Sell, the Cleveland Symphony, came to play at Finney Chapel. crescendos. And I walked out of there changed, just in the way that you have moments in your life of things. And I went to the conservatory where I knew a couple of kids. They said, tell me what I should study. I spent a lot of my time my freshman year in the evenings listening to records. To this day, I can remember one of the signal moments of my existence, the three nights I listened to Tristan Isolde and Wagner's opera. And you know, and even now, if I hear the love duet or the lead, my hands will break out and sweat. You can understand why mothers did not let their daughters listen to this music. Anyway, I loved Oboe. It changed my life. I started off as an English major. Well, not as an English major. I started off as a biology major. But unfortunately, I discovered that, like James Thurber, I could only see my eyelashes in the microscope. This is a real problem if you're going to be a bio major. So I switched to economics, and I would write these crazed papers on things like Henry George and the single tax. Very influential on Bernard Shaw, by the way. And my economics teacher, and I had been the advisor of Stevenson on his runs for presidency, Tufts, Robert Tufts. He would write on my papers, you know, Mr. Durda, you actually write pretty well, but you don't understand economics at all. So I realized, of course, I was doomed to be an English major. But I took a minimum number of classes. I took a lot of French and history. But I wasn't doing well when I started off. My first grade in Oberlin was a D, when I thought I was doing my best. Had a wonderful teacher there, named Andrew Bongiorno. This was last year before I retired. Did you ever met Andrew Bongiorno? So I was in a class called 17th Century Metaphysical Poetry. I was a freshman. I was supposed to be only for junior and senior majors. I'd gotten in through a strange fluke. I didn't know until it was too late. But he was a wonderful teacher. He'd been at Oakwood since 1918. He'd come there except for 6 years at Cornell. I lived into his late 90s, so I used to go back and see him. But I told him when I was first there that I was thinking of being an English major, and he'd strongly discouraged me. I didn't know what I was going to do. My French teacher, by the way, I was taking a lot of French, and I'm getting back my papers from Vino Rossi, was his name, in New York, by the way. He would always say, you know, what's the worst grade you can get? And I'd give it to an F, you know. Someone would say, an A, because that meant you were brown. I said, no, it's a C+. That means you're mediocre. And I said, these being C+. So I was ready to quit school. Yeah. And then in the middle of my first semester, but my father said, you know, my father never had a kind word for anyone, least of all his only son. So a lot of these kids have had advantages you haven't had, but if you worked harder than anybody else, you'd be okay. So I'd been kind of a cavalier, juvenile delinquent kind of kid, so, and decided, well, this is my chance. I needed to become blind in order to do well. So I did. You know, studied all the time. I had a girlfriend, and I studied as all as I in community college. And it worked for me, although in some ways I kind of destroyed a certain joie de vivre I used to have as a teenager. I never quite fully recovered. I wish I did, you know, thinking about Freud and Chamberlain and Christ. But anyway, I finally, I remember the French class, the teacher, decided I would try and do well. And an explication, his weekly explication of the text. And it was a poem by Paul Valéry. And I read this poem over, memorized it, and walked around all week, did nothing else but think about symbolism and assonance and alliteration and all those things you do when you're trying to analyze poetry. I wrote this paper. This weekly paper. This time I got back a B +++++++ with the note saying, Mr. Durda, you have actually written a paper in which there are interesting and original ideas, but your French is so bad, I can't possibly give it away. So I took stylistics and print. Anyway, by the time I got out of college, this was, I, I, Well, I did go to France in the summer of 1968, the great glorious summer of 1968. I was in Paris at the end of May, if you remember the events of May. I was in Tennessee, when Martin Luther King was shot. There was a lot of places where things were happening. There's a tendency for a while for people to turn against the 60s, but I've always felt that Wordsworth, who was in Paris during the French Revolution, wrote the prelude, "Bliss was in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very happy." That's what I feel about the 60s. Anyway, but I wanted to go back to France. I went back to France on Fulbright and taught at Lycée Marseille. Then went to graduate school of comparative literature at Cornell University. Spent 2 years in medieval studies. I was about to write my dissertation when I had an epiphany while reading Gregory the Great's Moralia and Job, a 4,000-page commentary on the Book of Job, which I came to a passage that went something like, "For whosoever is relaxed with the pleasures of lust, and goes to all the other deadly sins, what else is he but a testicle of Antichrist?" This I thought was incredibly funny. I mean, Gregory was always saying things like this. And I realized I probably didn't have the right sensibility to medievals after all, so I took 2 more years of courses in European Romanticism. Cornell's very strong in both medieval studies and European Romanticism. M.H. Abrams was the great figure there. And he lived about 102 years. He was Harold Bloom's teacher. And I wrote my dissertation on Stendhal as an autobiography. But before I did that, I was figuring I would teach in an English department, because even though I knew French pretty well, I never thought I would know it well enough to really be comfortable as a teacher of French, but certainly not in college level. So I looked for work, and I was offered a job at the University of Houston and a couple of other interesting places, but my then girlfriend, now long my wife, didn't want to go there. She was in Washington. She worked to see Marion as a Princeton Drawings Conservative at the National Gallery of Art. But that, before that, she was a paper conservative at the Library of Congress. She's probably the only person alive who's touched on the Declaration of Independence, the long false map of Washington, as well as $1 million works of art. So she's far more distinguished in her field than I am. She's trained a lot of people all around the world. Including a guy when she was at the library. There was a black kid from Anacostia who was working in the library, and she thought he had sensitive hands, and so she took him under her wing and trained him. He's now the head of conservation at Princeton University. So anyway, she didn't say, "I don't want to leave Washington, you know, I don't want to go to Houston, it's hot down there, you know, it's so whatever." So I said, "Okay, I'll stay in Washington and find something to do." So what I did find to do was translated from Berlitz, I did some work for trade journals, and I took a job as a technical writer for a computer company. This was back before personal computers, where I thought time sharing was going to be the future. And I worked mainly on financial planning systems for banks. So I was writing a manual, 2-volume manual, using APL, a very concise programming language. It's a programming But I really didn't understand computers very well, and didn't understand banking at all. And so I've always thought I was probably responsible for the savings and loan crisis. Since I was teaching these things. At which point I realized, you know, I'm not doing what I should be doing. You know, you're supposed to follow your bliss. I was a book person. I'd come to Washington with everything I owned to fit in an old Impala, but Washington was filled with used bookstores, you know, Goodwills, charity shops, big annual book sales, a Vassar sale, Goodwill sale, Brandeis sale, Stone Ridge. And I was going to all of them, I was loading up on books, having a great time. I said, well, I need to do something with books. I'd gotten a PhD, I was background. So I said, aha, what I'll do is I'll review books. I'll write a book review. So I wrote a letter to the editor of the book section of the Post, which is called Book World in those days. Back when I first started, it was still just it's part of the broadsheet on Sunday. It was the regular-sized art section. The book world had 3 or 4 pages in it. But it was edited by a guy named Bill McPherson. And I wrote to Bill, my most winning letter. call up on the day I said I would. So I'm the secretary of the story. She says, who are you? You know, whoever you are, just go away. I'm sure you'll listen to my document. You're a very good secretary. But it turned out Bill had liked my letter, and so he called me and we had coffee. He said he'd send me a book. Weeks go by, months go by. Finally, one day I get a call from a guy named Chris Suplee, who's an assistant editor there. Could I review a book called In the Suicide Mountains by John Gardner? This is the John Gardner who wrote our moral fiction, Grendel, Monster from Beowulf from Monster's point of view. Not so much forgotten. I naturally said, yes, of course I can do that. It's just a 200-word brief notice. And we had usually when we tried out people before then. It's 200 words, you got to sign what you mean. I, of course, had never written a book review in my life. I've never worked in a newspaper. I never read a word of John Gardner. But I got home that Friday, their book had been sent by courier. I was really impressed by that. Waiting there. And there was no review slip. You know, I didn't know when the book review was due. You know, they'd forgotten to tell me, but the only thing that I knew about newspapers was from the movies. But they were always saying, get me rewrites, sweetheart, and, you know, stop the presses and all that sort of stuff. So I figured, well, I read the book that night. And the next morning, I spent all day writing these 200 words. So they were perfect. And probably the best writing I've ever done. It's all been downhill since then. Anyway, I got out my typewriter. Hermes 3000 manual portable typewriter. And then had my real stroke of genius. Marrying my wife, girlfriend, and my parents. She's an expert on paper. That's her field. She's new, knows everything about paper. And I said, do you have any kind of bronze paper, you know, typewriter paper that you need? She happened to have this heavy Italian bond paper that sort of secretly thought was found parchment. So I put it in there and typed the stuff perfectly. And I write this little casual seeming note into the fountain pen. Oh, this will do, there'll be adding more. Put it all in an envelope, drive down to the main post office in Washington, which is open on Saturday nights till midnight. They still be calling them. And drop it in the mail. Whole world had the review Monday morning. Everybody was new. They'd sent the book on Friday, and they had the review on Monday. But they got the new work. This had never happened. It never happened again. usually when you sign a book for review, you know, you give 3 or 4 weeks, no matter what the length of the review, and invariably, about 3 days before it's due, you get a call from the reviewer saying, you know, whimpering, piteously, you know, might I have, you know, a couple more days. But that didn't happen. They all were impressed. They claimed to like the review. The art director used a piece of art I suggested for the book. Most important is by these little odds and ends that our fates are determined. Bill McPherson, this incredibly decadent aesthetic, really, he said to me, where did you get this paper? It's obvious the review was really secondary importance on this paper. And I'd been in Washington long enough, you know, to know it's a city that runs by quid pro quo. You know, my background, you know, Washington hand, whatever that means, you know, back and forth. So I said, they'll give me some more assignments, so maybe they'll get you a ream of this stuff. So they had to give me more work, and they liked it, and I wrote more reviews and longer reviews, and they've written a dozen. They asked me if I'd be interested in a job. At the time, I was working at Scientific Time Sharing Corporation, working on my financial planning system manuals, and I needed to come try out. It was a small section, and everybody has to, you know, cover a wide area, and they wanted to know we'd get on, and how to get on with it. So I had a week's vacation at the STSC for 6 months, and 1 week, so I took it. At the end of that week, Bookworld offered me a job, and so I went back and thought about it for a while. And I could, you know, I figured, you know, I could see that computer. going nowhere. But newspapers, they were reliable. You would never have any trouble with newspapers. They were solid, bedrock. Not flighty like these digital things. So I started working at Book World. That was in 1978. And I worked there for a long time, for 25 years as a staff. I was deputy editor for a while, and I was the editor. Probably I didn't want to be editor because I wanted to do write off. And I could do that. The deputy editor actually got out the section. The new editor had to deal with administrative issues. So I started the science fiction column, the mysteries column, and children's book column. I wrote the children's book column for a decade myself, once a month. I had all sorts of features, and did all lots of fun things. Book World was an incredibly exciting newspaper back in at the time when I was there. Not that it is now, but it's different. Years went by. My father, you recall, never thought I, it amounted to anything. And he figured that if I was supposed to be so smart, why wasn't I really rich? Why did I have a big car, a swimming pool, national hill or something? But I said, well, those are nice things to have, but they don't interest me as much. I have a job I really like and get well paid, it's fine. But then I decided I needed to impress him. Never to really, my father was an incredibly mean person. You read all about it. So I resolved that I would win the Pulitzer Prize. That was impressive. And so the Post nominated me for 3 years in a row for criticism. I had won. Well, I don't think I was any better or any worse than the other one. But as these things happened, my father died 6 months previous. So the reason I wanted to win was but I did get to. My mother's a kind of peasant. And I say that in kind, but my mother's still alive. I go to see her a week or two. She's in the nursing home. I go to see her all every 3 months for a week. We play a lot of fighting. Hours and hours of fighting. So her mind is good. Just her body is kind of shy. But she believes in the balance of the universe. This Taoist theory. Something good happens to you, something bad happens. It all balance out. Something good happens to a member of your family, something negative will happen to somebody else. Equivalence is maintained. So I call her up and say, Mom, I won the Pulitzer Prize. Long pause on the phone. And she says, well, guess there's no point in going to bingo tonight. So that keeps everything in perspective. Anyway, I was pretty happy at Book World, except that I wanted to write more. I was then after that I was working half time as an editor, half time as a writer, and I was getting feel that I was losing touch with the generation. I was getting older. I was still reviewing, interested in. Saul Bellow and Philip Roth, but there was a whole new generation of young writers coming along. And I really thought that we should have someone younger being responsible. I was responsible kind of for literary coverage. I was thinking about making some sort of change when the Post offered a voluntary buyout in editorial for reporters and editors. And I knew they didn't want me to leave entirely and would offer me a contract, so I would become a weekly book review. So I read Henry Maud. Mary had gone back to work full time at the National Gallery. She worked at the library for 15 years, stayed on for about 6 or 7 years when we had three sons who were now pretty much grown. But when they were little, I worked part time at the National Archives and then worked at the National Gallery, where she's worked for the last 5 or 7 years. So she was working full time, and I think, well, this is the chance to do it. So I took the buyout, became a weekly reviewer, review on Thursdays in the style section of the Post. For a while I reviewed in Book World, but about 7 or 8 years ago, we dissolved the book section. Book World was a 16-page magazine, just like the New York Times Book Review, 16 pages. And we thought they would save money by just squishing the reviews through style and outlook in the editorial page on Sunday. So the sort of last dozen years I've reviewed for, on Thursdays. So it's been sort of hard. I don't regret making the choice. Although my wife thinks I'm slowly going crazy since I sit home all day and never see anybody. But when I was a book writer, I had a full page, and I could write 1,800 word pieces, long pieces. Then I went to style after that, and I had to write 1,200 word pieces. And then recently now they discovered through the analysis of attention spans on digital stuff that, you know, 950 words is the max before people are retired or whatever it is they're reading. So now I write 950 word reviews. But I decided when I took the buyout that I would write for other places a lot. When I'd been at Book World, I didn't really have time to do anything except I wrote a weekly review or essay. For a long time, I wrote a monthly essay, not essay, it's more for readings, it's a collection of those too. Put out the section. So I could now write for other places. So I began to write for New York Review of Books and Times Review or something. Although for the TLS, I mostly write essays for the Freelance column, which are very personal. We rather like the pieces in this book. We'll probably collect them sometime. And I produce books. I've tried to do a book every 2 years. With readings, collection of columns of readings. An open book was a memoir, takes me up to the age of 19. Bound to Please is a fairly serious book about world literature. Book by Book was a little tiny book based on my commonplace book. A commonplace book is a notebook where you copy favorite extracts when you're reading. And I have lots of interesting quotes and written mini essays and book lists and other things. So it's a nice little inside breviary. One of them, I'll always remember best, is one of them goes, old age is the most unexpected of all the things that happens to men. Who said that? Trotsky. Anyway, and then after that was a book called Classics for Pleasure. That began when a guy named Andre Bernard, who's the vice president of the Guggenheim Foundation now, and also the Century Association, president of the was then working, it was the editor of Harper Brothers. Andre had started off in book publishing as an understudy, an assistant to Clifton Fadden, the Book of the Month Club. Some of you are old enough to remember Clifton Fadden, the Lifetime Reading Plan. Maybe you'll be back to Information Please or radio. He knew that Fadden was important to me, because he read the memoir where I talked about being in a department store, noticing a rack of paperbacks that I'd never seen before. Lorraine didn't have any bookstores. I would often go to drugstores and department stores where they had books and just stand there and read the entire block in the afternoon. But I went to this paperback, and there were coverless books in little plastic bags. And there was like 50 cents for three of them. They didn't have any copies. Of course, I understand now they were not supposed to sell these books. They were supposed to pulp them and they sent the covers back for credit. But they wanted to make a few extra pennies. But of course, the problem was that I realized that, that looking at the titles on the spine, the books I was interested in were all in three different bags. So what to do? I've always carried a pocket knife. So I split open the bags and I rearranged them. So I got three that sounded good. And I grabbed my finger over the slit in the plastic bag and went to the cashier's, pumped down my 50 cents, ran outside of the room. While I was waiting in the car and jumped in and said, you know, drive. I remember the books I got. One was a Sam Durrell spy thriller. Sam Durrell is a kind of American James Bond. It's called Simon and Kara. They all had titles Simon Susi, Simon, this or that. Pretty bad. They're really not really good thrillers. But they're all does good is not talent. The other book was a book by a guy who went on to become famous for a quite different book. It was a very funny, humorous, autobiographical novel. Supposedly, I thought it was autobiographical, but it came out of the West Coast fiction house. Called Which Way to Mecca, Jack? And it was by William Peter Blatty. Later when I was his first book, later went on to write The Exorcist. The third book was The Lifetime Human Plan. And so I took that and I read it and realized that Fadiman wrote about books in a way that made them sound, and they were exciting. They were, you know, he made classic sounds as exciting as Tarzan. He had a tone of voice. It was conversational, easygoing, and I immediately took to this. Eventually read all his essays and all his books. And I, later on when I realized I was going to be a literary journalist, I'd been reading all along people who were the kind of writer that Fadiman was. There's an English critic, Lucille Conlon, famous melancholy, self-pitying character who's just delightful prose styles. Kenneth Clarkson, the best prose styles in the century. In Evil Law, they write some friends. There are a number of Randall Jarrell. I loved Randall Jarrell's poetry criticism. He was so witty. He was famous for his put downs. And great appreciator as well. But I mean, what's it about the poet Oscar Williams? His poems sound as if they were written on a typewriter and by a typewriter. But I like this light touch. I like things that were light and witty and conversational. I detest the kinds of critics who are Olympian. And there's this slight tone of condescension and stiffness about whatever they say. I used to have above my desk, one of a couple of mottos I had. One was from Henry James, "Be one on whom nothing is lost." And the other was a famous remark by Cromwell, says to Parliament or something, "Consider in the bowels of Christ that it's possible you might be mistaken." So not quite that, but that's basically it. I mean, it's not a good idea for a critic to ever doubt himself, but I've got sometimes said when I gave decorative reviews, I could be wrong here, I try to be a human being. I try to come across as someone who's a reader talking to other readers. And my pleasure as a journalist is to try and convey pleasure to other people. If I can excite you to want to try a book because I was excited by it, that's what I hope to do. But at Book World, I also long felt that I wanted to urge people to read beyond the bestseller list. I wanted them to rediscover really interesting books from the past, to read books from other cultures, from other languages, that the world of literature could speak to us in such much more wide range of tones and various kinds of appeals than the bestseller list, which is a certain kind of book becomes a bestseller. I early on resolved that I would never review books that I thought were going to become bestsellers, unless I was forced to. I was forced to a couple of times. I don't normally write negative reviews or tend to write appreciations. That was partly because I was an editor. If I didn't like the book, I would put on my editor's hat and sign it to somebody else. But now and again, I would have to review something popular that my colleague said, I should do. Remember the one? Remember Judith Krantz? Maybe she lived there. Anyway, Scruples and Princess Daisy have been very well received as, Euro trash romances. And that was fine. I love science fiction and fantasy. My closest friends are in science fiction and fantasy, war. I love crime fiction. I'm a member of the Baker Street Irregulars. It's a little doobad is. Forgotten that I had left it on. And, I said, I'll review this new book by her called Dazzle. It's just dreadful. just, sex is boilerplate, nothing's original. And I started the review by saying, I read Judith Krantz's Dazzle in one sitting. I had to. I was afraid I couldn't face picking it up again. And that's when I destroyed the book. And ended with, you know, sometimes critics lament that good trees were felled. You know, in the case of Judith Krantz's Dazzle, I even feel bad for the ink and the glue. Well, like I said, you shouldn't write negative reviews. They were bad for your character. Anyway, so I started to write more and more. And so for the last dozen years, I've been a freelancer. And I will write for almost anybody who will pay me. Or teach. I taught some at local colleges, McDaniel College, University of Maryland, as a visiting professor down in Florida. Last courses I taught at University of Maryland was on the invention line. This was called the Classic Adventure Novel, 1885 and 1915. Started with King Solomon's Mines, Kidnapped, Time Machine, Scarlet Pimpernel, Prisoner of Zenda, Tarzan of the Apes, The Man Who Was Thursday, Kim, several other. E. Nesbitt's The Story of the Android. All wonderful books. And then I did another one the following semester on modern adventure novel. And that was bookended by princesses. It began with Edgar Rice Burroughs' The Princess of Mars, and it ended with William Goldman's The Princess Bride. And I had lots of other adventure novels in between. And that course, along with a little book I wrote on about Conan Doyle, which created my interest in Sherlock Holmes and the Baker Street Irregulars and Conan Doyle himself, led me to the project I'm working on now, which is called tentatively The Great Age of Storytelling, which is going to be a book about popular fiction in the late 19th and early 20th century. This period when you had the birth of all the modern genres, detective fiction, horror, fantasy, children's literature. Everything really comes out of this period when we had mass literacy for the first time, cheap paper, the technology of printing magazines cheaply and deliver them, funded by trains and various places, people. And you didn't yet have the competition of radio and TV and all that. So you had this burgeoning of magazine fiction. And I'm writing about it. That's why I bought it. You know, I've already written about it before. Wall Street Journal once. There was some issues in a couple of his books. But I still collect the Oppenheimers and Edgar Wallace and John Buchan, just named. But all, you know, the Lives of Sherlock Holmes, and we've heard about Max Carados, the born detective, or Dr. Thorndike, and I love Ian Nesbitt's books. I really think these are wonderful stories. This is people are really good at storytelling. And in creating iconic figures like Sherlock Holmes and Peter Pan and Scarlet Pimpernel. So that I think it's just a fun period to rediscover. There are, you know, there are prejudices of the time you have to sometimes deal with, but they're not so bad as you might think. And usually you can figure out this is the period when people felt these things and move on. Anyway, I'm working on a book. I hope that will be done in the fall. This book, Browsings, came about because a friend of mine named Bob Wilson is the editor of the American Scholar magazine. I've actually once been asked, twice asked, if I would be considered trying to be the editor. Once I did, and I lost Anne Fathom, Clifton's daughter, who became the editor for a long time. She did very for me. So that was all right. But I wasn't even sure I wanted the job. So I was pretty happy with those. But anyway, Bob had become the editor and had done it for a few years. He asked me if I would write a weekly essay for their blog, or their online homepage. And I said I would do it for a year. So I started off. I'm supposed to write very short pieces, 600 words. The first one is about William Zinsser, who I was succeeding, somebody who made William Zinsser on Writing Well, and read many books and articles in life and all sorts of excellent essays and journals. So I started with him and then wrote longer and longer pieces. And we discussed things that interested me. And so I write about the decline of handwriting, of the year I lived in Marseille, about Oberlin, about rants about Pepco occasionally, the company that struck me without power for a week. If you have a basement filled with books and you don't have a dehumidifier running for a week, you can run into some serious problems. Then there were funny pieces about anglophilia, going to science fiction conventions, about returning home and visiting my the house I grew up in, which is now MP, and thinking about the past. It's quite a touching friend of mine here. Phyllis Reynolds Naylor, a well-known children's author, and Shiloh, she said that was the best message by far. She cried and she did about the passage of time. And basically how I missed my young parents, my father was dead and so. And I write funny things about writer's block and anything at all that had a bookish or literary connection that struck me on Monday and morning. I would write them as a kind of a relief from the more serious book reviews I was doing. So I wrote them fast. They had a real topicality. They came out in 2012, 2013. I didn't change it much. I cleaned up a few odds and ends, but basically the essays are as they should still. And I did try very much to make them light. I wanted them to be entertaining. My first book, Readings, was called Essays of Literary Entertainments. And I like that idea that you can make. You don't have to always be out there climbing Mount Everest. You can just take a little walk and talk about things you like and stuff like that. But I worked hard not to sound too smarmy or cutesy or personal. I don't like it with people that way. So I often make fun of myself. There's a lot of that kind of self-deprecation. It's easier to make fun of myself to me anyway. How far I've fallen short of my ideals and goals. I'll read you a little passage basically the kind of stuff I just talked about now are the kind of pieces you find in here. Although I've not talked about any of it before, because you might be interested in what there's a lot about me and how I can do these sorts of things. Here's the essay about handwriting. He's called Scribble Scribble. And I'll just read the first three paragraphs. My three sons, all in their early to mid-20s, could sign their names when they concentrate. But that's just about it. During their elementary school years, Chris, Mike, and Nate were pitching off the mysteries of cursive handwriting. But since then, they've tapped their thumbs on smartphone keyboards far more often than they gripped the pen or pencil. Though their typing may eventually lead to repetitive stress syndrome, they'll never develop a callus on the top knuckle of the middle finger of their right hand, as most of us have. My own handwriting is essentially illegible to anyone other than myself. And after a few days, even I can't always make out the meaning of my scribbles. Deciphering my lists of important things to do would challenge Champollion far more than breaking the secret of the Rosetta Stone. Eminent doctors, envious of a scrawl of such complete and utter capacity, have come to me and humbly asked if I might conduct seminars or offer master classes at medical conventions. And I go on to talk about the time I tried to learn calligraphy and that one too. I tell a story about, Marion, I worked at the Library of Congress under the famous book conservator, changed the book by Peter Waters. Peter Waters was in charge of the restoration of the books during Florence Flood. He and his older partner, Roger Powell, they were people who rebound Booker Cowles. Peter, arguably the lead, greatest bookbinder then alive, was married to Sheila Waters, arguably the greatest calligrapher alive, member of the only American person in North America under the Stripes and Lineage at that time. like this, and she would scribble, do letters on the board. I would go up after this, get sheets down and say, because they were so beautiful. She did the monogram on our wedding, you know, our interlaced initials. And her son Julian did the inside, the directions. Julian never went to college. His mother trained him. And he was for a decade or more. He was the head house school for all the communications and stuff like that. Anyway, so I had this interest in calligraphy, and I tried to learn it and talk about that. There are a lot of these pieces I think are, well, not exactly jokey, but they have jokes in them. And I think they're kind of funny. I really don't, I'm going to stop in a second and we'll open the floor for questions, because I have rather long. Right into the last part, the end of the last essay, where I've sort of given some final bits of advice, the way that you do our last essays, which I think is called Positively Final Appearance, borrowed from Mellick Innocence of autobiography. Well, I could go on with numbers 4, 5, and 6. I've been making a list of things, whatever they might be, but I don't want to be overly pedantic or allow this farewell to go on too long. Elizabeth Bubesco, Princess Bubesco, Los Commons, once said that a goodbye, like a welcome, shouldn't be overextended. It is not the being together that it belongs, it is the parting. Still, I've never been able to write even a note to a milkman, back when there were milkmen, without a P.S. So just let me stress one last time that the world is full of wonderful stories, heartbreakingly beautiful and witty poems, thrilling works of history, biography, and philosophy. They will make you laugh, or hug yourself with pleasure, or deepen your thinking, or move you as profoundly as any experience this side of a serious love affair. None of us, of course, will ever read all the books we like. We can still make a stab at it. Why deny yourself all that pleasure? So look around tonight and this weekend. See what catches your fancy on the bookshelf, at the library, or in the bookstore. Maybe try something a little unusual, a little different. And then don't stop. Do it again. With a new book or an old author the following week. Go on, be bold, be insatiable, be restlessly, unashamedly promiscuous. You happen to have, of course, sneaking him into the house so he doesn't know when he's there. Okay. There are probably hiding places he hasn't discovered yet. You can try to figure those things out. Otherwise, you can encourage him to find a hobby of his own. Maybe he collects stamps, that they don't take up much room. You can still have your books. But no, my wife, you know, is always off that on, you know, after being up to sleep like that. There's several stories where I talk about my beloved spouse and putting up with me in the books that I bring home. You can rent a storage unit. That's another good option. But no, there is no help for it, I'm afraid. You're doomed if he's obviously, if, I don't know if it's honest, but if he's willing to put up with you and your books, you should count yourself lucky. And if he's not, I used to know a guy whose wife told him, you know, the books go where I go, and one day he came back from a business trip, discovered that she had thrown all the books out, given them away or sold them, they were gone. He divorced her the next week, and was spending the following years trying to reassemble them. That's another option. I'm not encouraging that one, but you know, you can bear it in mind. Other questions? Yes.
Extremely funny and satirical.
how do you balance being, you know, the correction of taste, so to speak, with being still easygoing and likable and informative and the like? It is something of a, you know, balancing act. But, you know, I've always believed that the criticism, St. Augustine said, has to start with love. So my initial feeling of when I read a book is, you know, if I'm not getting it, it's probably I'm failing it somewhere. And so I try hard to see if I'm, you know, I'm being fair to the author. And I've not, and whenever I've been tempted to be, use the common word, snarky, I try to think, you know, to write just an ordinary novel takes so much time, effort, and energy. And to dismiss it in a cruel sentence or two is just really unfair and not worthwhile. I mean, I did with Judith Krantz because it would make no difference in that case. She's meretricious. But no, I do think that the essence of criticism is not that final judgment, you know, this will do or this will never do, but description. You describe accurately what is there on the page. What kind of a book is this? You quote to give a sense of the style. You might compare lightly this book to the author's other books or to other books in that field, give a sense of context. And you present the information as richly as you can, but with whatever kind of stylishness is your own, so that people find it enjoyable to read. When I first started at the paper, there was a national reporter named Bill Dreyer, who went to work for the Rolling Stone for the Nation, said about soft news, about features, like reviews. Writing that isn't fun to read doesn't get read. So I always try to make what I write at some level fun and entertaining. And then I very much believe in, you know, kind of pedagogy to what I do as well. You will learn a lot, but I don't want it to sound as though, you know, I'm just a wadi-da, and I know everything you don't. That's not the case, because I know I don't. I'm really trying to tell you what I see there, and as somebody who has read a lot of books, I can bring to bear a lot of useful material in illuminating. Anyway, one tries, one fails. You know, a famous thing from Beckett, try again, fail again, fail again. Yeah.
Since you're an admirer of crime fiction,
yes,
I wonder what you think of the remark that King Amos once made. The remark was, John D. MacDonald is, by any measure, a better writer than Saul Bellow.
Well, you know, Kingsley Amos was always saying that sort of thing. He was a wonderfully witty writer, an excellent critic, I think, too. And he did love crime fiction. We share a particular admiration for John Dixon Carr, the master of the Loch Ness mystery. I remember reading Amos said a long piece in the TLS years ago, pegged to a posthumous collection of Carr's called The Doors. Doors of Perception, all deception, it's something like that. Detection, Doug Green edited it. Anyway, he starts about talking about the burning court. Have you ever read the burning court, John Dixon Carr? It's wonderful. I mean, this is Amos. To show you what he's stressing the same sort of point that he's making with John McDonald. There's an editor, book editor, New York book editor, is on a train going up to Pennsylvania, wherever it is. And he's got a manuscript about a history of witchcraft and demonology and all sorts of weird stuff. And he's looking at it on the train, and at the end of the final chapter, there's pictures and illustrations, and there's an account of some mysterious witch who might be, seemingly has lived for hundreds of years, and the last sentence of the book, they have a picture of her in the book, is he was looking at a picture of his own wife. You get home and you go through and what happens afterwards in the book. And it is an amazing story because he sets it up and he gives you the logical ending in a way that all of his logical mysteries that seem supernatural are ultimately rationalized. But then in this book, he gives an extra twist. Anyway, yes, there are different kinds of writers. You know, I'm a Maoist when it comes to fiction. You know, let let a thousand blossoms flower, you know, let a thousand flowers blossom. You know, there's room for every kind of fiction. Amos would like to be provocative. You know, it's you know, a way of gaining attention. But he also did love those sorts of books. So, and yes, he could be incredibly funny about Saul Bellow if you read his letters. His letters, my book Bound to Please has a long, if I had a copy of it, and he's a brilliant put down to Saul Bellow, who he really disliked. So it's really charming that his son Martin Amos reveres Saul Bellow in the way of the world, you know, fathers and sons. Other questions? Yes?
Yes. Mr. Durger, you're so entertaining to listen to. I'm wondering if you would ever entertain the following. There was a book critic up in Massachusetts where I'm from named Robert Hale, and he would go to places, in my case it was the Wenham Tea House, very provincial,
wow.
But we had a wonderful book department there. And he would come with a stack of books that were very varied, an autobiography, a mystery, a fiction, but he had great passion about each of the books that he would bring. And he'd have them stacked on the table and he'd review each book. And he would whet our appetites so well for these books that we'd buy all of them and love them home. And it's wonderful when you can have a book right in front of you physically.
Oh.
And
so let me get this straight.
Okay.
He was not a reviewer in a newspaper, but he worked in a bookstore. He would just talk about the books.
He was a book critic.
He would talk to people in the bookstore about the books?
He would, to groups. For instance, it would be lovely at the library. And it just, to have these books and maybe a few classics involved too.
Well,
and it would be so rich for us to have you do
well,
that.
I used to do something like that back in the days when the Stone Ridge Youth Book Sale existed in Washington. It doesn't exist anymore. They asked me to come and go around the book sale, all these tables of used books, and talk about why these books are, pluck out books and say why you should read this one, what's good about this one, and sell them, basically, hand sell them right then and there. They love that. It's time consuming. I live by my pen. And, basically, except for local libraries and schools, I can't do anything for free, otherwise my rent won't be. Anyway, I can't afford to buy food. So I have to make a living, so I have to think about that sort of thing. Other more questions?
Over here?
Yes.
Yep. It reminds me that in New England they have all these wonderful book sales.
Yeah.
And they used to have wonderful tag sales of people's libraries, but over the years you see the deterioration of private libraries where people used to have really wonderful collections of books. Now they basically have their old economics Samuelson textbooks.
Wow, awesome.
And the complete works of Stephen King and Judith Krantz. I mean, they have books, but they don't have libraries in the sense.
Yeah.
And it really is a kind of
statement
on what we've lost. But my question is this. Why is it? It appears to me that the English book reviewers and the TLS, the London Review of Books, and particularly the Spectator, are so much more interesting to read as essays than American reviews, with the exception, of course, with the New York Review of Books, which does long essays on particular themes, nonfiction particularly. Why is it that it's so pleasant to read the British reviewers and not
they have all these advantages over them. They speak so wonderfully well, they have different traditions, of course, in book reviewing there. In America, aside from specialist magazines, if you're writing for a newspaper or for most kinds of reviews, a certain level of impartiality, objectivity is de rigueur. There they like you to go damage drawn and have opinions and be much more propositional and adversarial and anything to make you live. That's also true of New York Review of Books. I mean, Bob Silvers often has people who are friends of the authors reading the book, so long as they can write something they think is lively and interesting, that's all they're really interested in. But the decline of libraries is something I've, you know, lamented too. I go to used bookstores now a lot, and I see all these shiny dust jackets. I say, no, those aren't used books. Those are books of the last 30 years. You know, all books I've seen before. I want to see books I don't normally see. I want to see, you know, faded spines, worn covers, which you have to pull off the shelf in order to peer at them, in order to see what the titles are. Those are the books that are going to be unusual and interesting. I mean, one day, I've only read, I gave a talk this past Saturday at a Lewis Carroll conference about books influenced by Alice in Wonderland, and I had a number of these books, but there was one I wanted to read, and I couldn't find it and buy it at the time, a little copy. So I did read it on the screen on my computer. I don't have a Kindle or a laptop. That was the first one that I ever read. But basically, I'm a proponent of having real books in your house because they become a presence in your life. Having something on a computer or on an e-book reader, it's there, but it's not part of your daily existence. Now, I wake up, I see the books on shelves, they remind me, you know, you haven't read me, or you should leave me. They're chastised, you know. Or you see them and you say, oh, some people suddenly pluck one out and want to read a passage and put it back or whatever. They are integral to your existence. They become, you know, they're not just furnishing a room, they're furnishing your life. And that I don't think you have with digital books. Digital books are wonderful for travel and they have all their places and they will doubtless, you know, take over in the future. But they do not become, you know, blood of our blood, flesh of our flesh, in the way that the book does. Mm-hmm.
Well,
other questions? Yes?
Having written a few memoirs yourself, I'm curious what are some of your favorite memoirs and what makes a memoir?
Oh, I wrote one memoir per se, although a number of my books are personal and memoir-y and writing. The essence of writing a good memoir, autobiography, you have to have two things. There's this tension between what you'd call design and truth. Mm-hmm. Our lives are chaotic. There's a lot of stuff happens to us. You can't write about all of them in a memoir. Otherwise, we'd end up with more chaos. So you have to impose some kind of design. It's the choice of the design. What you're going to include, what you're going to leave out, that determines the shape of the memoir. Mine was called an open book because I decided reading is going to be the design element to organize my life. There was a lot of my life that doesn't appear in the book, although not that much, since reading was pretty central, so I chose it. But you have this tension going on. If you have too much of the factual stuff, you have a chaotic kind of book. If you have too much design, too much art, it becomes false. It's no longer true. You're imposing a kind of literary shape on your experience that isn't there, that's wrong. When you see these memoirs, which you sometimes see, where people have these extended conversations around the dinner table, families that go on for a couple of pages, I have an extremely good memoir. Well, I could not do that for my child. I could remember statues. But those things are completely fabricated. They're reconstructed. They're, you know, we come ultimately autobiography and memoir is a sort of debased form of fiction. It's a sort of veneer of truth around it. We all create myths of our lives. You know, I've traded on my working class background for years. You know, I've been working class for a long, long time. But that did shape me initially, but it's now becomes, you know, something that we count on, we feel about. As favorite memoirs, I wrote my dissertation on a memoir about Stendhal's The Life of Henri Boulard, and Vie de Henri Boulard. Henri Boulard is in fact Stendhal. He's really his only day of, and he's his name. He likes pseudonyms. But it's his own life up to the age of 19. You might remember that I just said my memoir went up to the age of 19. In fact, his book is the secret model behind the shape of my book. His book ends when he's the Wizard of France, when he goes to Italy, the Napoleonic armies, and has this great awakening into the glories of Italian past of opera and love and beautiful women and culture and everything for this young man. For me, it was when my book ends when I go to France. And I go to France in 1970. I went in 68 for the summer. I had a girlfriend that not who I was married to, who was going on a junior year abroad with Middlebury College. And I was there for the summer. She was going to be there for the academic year. Our paths would cross in Paris for one night. Her program was going to be coming to Paris and go on to the units. I was going back to go home the following day from summer. I saved my money all that summer. So I went in Paris. I'd been in Paris for 6 weeks at that point. I just taking a class for movie. But I went to a restaurant called La Perouse in Paris. I went there and reserved one of these little rooms. You could have really odd rooms that are enclosed. Prince Edward used to do it before he became King Edward. He'd take his mistresses there, and because anything could go on in these little rooms. It's also, if you read Proust, it's where Swann used to take Odette. And so I reserved this, and then you pick out, and I reserved a carriage ride to Bois de Boulogne afterwards, the works. And so Eleanor, that's her real name, I don't get rid of them, use her real name, I would change all the names of all the girls I was ever seen on the lawyers in Morton didn't change their mind. Unless they not want their association with me known to the world. Anyway, her ship was late, her bus was late, so she didn't roll in until like 11 o'clock. I'd also gotten a room in the hotel with her program to stay, and I'd left nothing to chance. Except, fate moves this huge hand, and she was late, so we went to a cafe and had something there, and had to cast money, nothing worked out. The next morning, she got on a bus to go to the train station, and I realized I had to see her one last time. So I knew the subways, and I got on the subways and reached to the bus station, and found the train she was on, and she was at the window, waving. I had to crank down the window, and grab the window, pull myself up on the side of the train, kiss her one last time. As the train starts to move out of the station, I drop off and I'm with tears running down my face. She later fell in love with a guy in this program, later married him. So, this is the way of the world. But I didn't know that at the time. But as I walked out of the train station, I realized I had sent like $200 or something. It was a lot of money. And in France. So I immediately went to a French bookstore and bought all these play-out editions of these classics, these expensive copies, and loaded up on them. So the book, this is where the memoir ends, with me, say goodbye to Eleanor and then and going home with the complete proofs and staying all the editions. So a little balance as well.
Mr. Durden, thank you so much.
Okay, time. I guess it's time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.